The headlines, Iran says there is nothing secret about the new construction at Natanz site and that the IAEA is fully informed of its efforts to tighten nuclear security. Israeli fighter jets bomb positions in the central and eastern Gaza. Hamas says the Palestinians will keep resisting. Also coming up, reports say the U.S. is expanding its illegal military bases in eastern Syria. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. Iran says it has already informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of new construction around Natanz nuclear facility. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says it is moving its centrifuge manufacturing plant to a site near Natanz for security reasons. Behruz Kamalvandi says the relocation is part of measures to tighten security around the nuclear facilities. They come after the terrorist operation that damaged the centrifuge plant in Karaj last year. Earlier, the New York Times reported that Iran is constructing new facilities deep under the mountains that are able to withstand bunker-busting bombs and cyber attacks. Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the reason why his country assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was to protect American resources. Pompeo was speaking with Saudi news network Al Arabiya. He said the U.S. killed General Soleimani to safeguard its assets in Iraq, its people in Syria, and in fact, Americans all across the world. Pompeo added that the assassination was an opportunity to stop what he called an imminent attack on U.S. positions. Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and was killed in January 2020. Pompeo said Washington had been monitoring the Quds Force activities. He also said Iran had already warned that there would be a war if Washington withdrew from the 2015 deal, moved its embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds, and killed Soleimani. However, Pompeo said the U.S. did all of those three, and there was no war. Today marks the fifth anniversary of an Iranian retaliatory missile strike on Daesh terrorists. In June 2017, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired missiles at the group's positions in Syria in response to the terror attacks in Tehran, which were claimed by Daesh. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Said Mustafa Khoshish, political commentator. Please help us revisit the moments from the terrorist attack on Iran's parliament, how Daesh had been trying to spread instability in Iran, and what Iran's response was, and, of course, how eventually those plots were frustrated.
Hello, and thanks for having me. You know, the attack, the strike on Daesh headquarters came after a couple of attacks, terrorist attacks on the Iranian parliament, as well as the IRGC march in southwestern Iran. But that was a planned move, actually, by Daesh, which was part of the U.S. hybrid warfare against Iran. At that time, the U.S. strategy had been enhanced to new levels to include different types of pressures and leverages against Iran. Part of it was through terrorist attacks to destabilize the country, major cities across the country, including the capital, Tehran, and also in economic areas, they have been harshening sanctions as well as foreign currency meddling in Iran. The media warfare had aggravated against the Islamic Republic, and also in several other areas, including cyber attacks, they were planning to, start mutinies in Iran, especially Tehran, the capital, all done to overthrow the Islamic Republic, as they claimed. I mean, the American administration claimed, but they failed. And it was one of the best retaliations done by Iran to display how powerful it is in military areas in the region. It's not just the power of the Iranian missile industries, but also the information and data, the intel that they needed to specify targets of Daesh headquarters. And it also showed the precision striking capability of the Iranian missiles. So It was one of the major moves that Iran and the U.S. on the broader strategy, the broader picture, they were making against each other. It was not just an Iranian move against Daesh. It was one of the moves done by Iran very powerfully in retaliation for the U.S. offensive strategy against the Islamic Republic, and it was very much successful.
So Mr. Khoshesh Pompeo has said that the U.S. did whatever it wanted to with impunity, but he failed to mention Iran's missile attack on Ain al-Assad Air Base, or Iran's warning that General Soleimani's killers will not be immune to justice. And now, with voices across the region growing for the U.S. military expulsion, do you see that as the right punishment deserving of such a crime?
Well, Pompeo, the former secretary, had better deal with his hiding place. I mean, he's been hiding. He's under a very heavy escort of bodyguards wherever he goes. That's why that's one of the reasons, actually, that they've been demanding from Iran is forgetting about retaliation for Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. And Iran has reiterated that no matter what happens to the talks, no matter what happens to anything else, the retaliation is for sure. And all those who have done this crime will pay the price. And it's not just Pompeo or his former boss, Mr. Trump, or Brian Hook. There are many others. Iran has released a list of 66 culprits. Some of them have already paid the price, according to some media outlets in the region. And the rest are standing on the list, and there's no doubt about that. But the Ain al-Assad story was just the beginning of Iran's hybrid responses. It's not just the one-story response retaliation. There will be many. On the broader picture, one could say that expelling the United States from the region is one of the ultimate goals on the strategic levels. But the Ain al-Assad attack or missile strike by Iran was a very symbolic move because it shattered the U.S. awe in the world. Even Chinese and Russians have been admitting that they've been feeling more respect for Iranians and Iran's military powers ever since Iran shut down the Global Hawk and ever since Iran Iranian missiles rained down on Ain al-Assad. The Ain al-Assad story displayed that Iran is not afraid, that Iran has very precise and powerful ballistic missile power that could hit anyone, or when it hits the U.S. airbase, it could hit anyone else. So it showed also the precision striking capability of Iran, that Iranian missiles cannot be intercepted. It showed the firepower of the Islamic Republic. And it was actually the first move to declare that the U.S. should leave the region. And ever since then, we've been witnessing the embarrassing retreat of the U.S. troops from across the region, including the Afghanistan, which was a reminiscent of their Vietnam fiasco, as well as their pullout of forces from two or three bases in Qatar, as well as the higher echelon of the U.S. CENTCOM in Doha, which has been transferred to the U.S. inside U.S. territories, all admittedly because of the Iranian missile power. Ever since then, you've not been hearing much about the U.S. threats against Iran, especially in the last 1 year. You've not been hearing American military or the Navy threatening Iran. They all realized in Washington that Iran is very much serious about the retaliation, and they should not give Iran any kind of excuse in the military field. So they have changed and shifted the area of warfare to semi-hard warfare, economic issues, as well as media and politics and propaganda, cognitive warfare and war of perception against Iranians, and sanctions and foreign currency meddling. Whatever they do, they avoid the military field because they know there will be a very heavy price to pay.
Thank you very much. That was Mr. Mustafa Khoshchashm, political commentator, joining us from Tehran. The lead up to the annual Hajj rituals is currently underway in Saudi Arabia, with a large number of Muslims from around the world getting together for the mass pilgrimage from the city of Medina Our correspondent Mehdi Abbasian is joining us to tell us more about this important religious congregation. Mehdi, tell us about the Hajj rituals and what is happening there. Apparently, you are in the holy city of Medina. Tell us about this important religious congregation.
Well, I'm currently in Medina, as you said. This year, after a two-year interval, Saudi Arabia has once again allowed pilgrims from all across the globe to visit the country in order to perform the Hajj pilgrimage. The country's, Saudi Arabia's Hajj ministry has announced that it will permit up to 1 million pilgrims from all over the world. And of that number, some 40,000 are expected to travel from Iran to Saudi Arabia. And currently in the city of Medina, it's quiet because just around a thousand, just thousands of Muslims have just arrived in Medina. Not more than that. Others are still on their way, and they will arrive here in the coming days.
Okay, thank you very much.
Back
that was Mehdi Abbasian, our correspondent, joining us from the holy city of Medina. We'll be in touch with Mehdi with more updates regarding this important ritual after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. Moving on, the Israeli military says it has struck Hamas military sites in the besieged Gaza Strip. The military says the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Palestinian territory. No group in Gaza has confirmed that, but Hamas has reacted to the strike, saying that they are part of continued Israeli aggression. Ashraf Shannon has more details.
The Israeli fighter jets carried out a number of airstrikes against Hamas security posts in the Gaza Strip since the early hours of today, completely destroying several of these posts in the east of the enclave and east of Gaza City, and also east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beth Hanun. These airstrikes and attacks come only about less than a day after Israeli drones attacked the Gaza Strip as well as tanks. Today's attacks, regarding today's attacks, the Israeli regime alleges that a rocket that was fired from Gaza and hit the city of Ashkelon in the north of the Gaza Strip, although no one has confirmed in Gaza firing rockets. Meanwhile, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem reacted to the airstrike, saying that these Israeli attacks are is a continuation of the Israeli aggression against Palestinians all over Palestine. And he said that the Palestinian resistance will continue to fight the Israeli occupation until the liberation.
The United States is reportedly expanding its military bases in Syria, reinforcing them with air defense systems. Russia's Sputnik News agency says the U.S. is relocating military convoys in eastern Syria, launching modern radar systems on bases already built there. The agency, citing local sources, also says American forces are using grain warehouses in the north as checkpoints and to keep military equipment. The U.S. is keeping its presence in Syria despite strong opposition from the Damascus government. Syria says the U.S. is looting its resources under the guise of fighting terrorism. Syria is also opposed to Turkey's presence on its soil. That has recently come to the spotlight again as Turkey has announced plans for a military operation in northern Syria. Ankara says it aims to eliminate Kurdish groups, which it views as terrorists. Independent Kurdish politician Usman Hasan Pasha says the autonomous Kurdistan region in northern Iraq is smuggling oil to Israel. Pasha says the smuggling is taking place under the supervision of Kurdistan's authorities. He says Turkey is offering support as its ports are hosting the three oil tankers involved in this activity. According to the Kurdish politician, 40,000 to 80,000 barrels of oil are smuggled to Israel every week. He has called on the central government in Baghdad to investigate the issue. Pasha says that the smuggling is taking place at a time when people in Kurdistan are facing serious fuel crisis. Now to Afghanistan, where an attack hit a Sikh temple in the capital Kabul on Saturday morning. At least two people were killed and seven others wounded. That is according to Taliban officials. They say the dead include a Sikh worshipper and a Taliban member who was killed in the ensuing clashes. The Taliban say attackers had laden cars with explosives, driving it into the area, but it went off before reaching its target. The Taliban say the site is now secured. No groups has claimed responsibility for the attack. On Friday, a bomb blast hit a mosque in the northern Kunduz province, killing one and injuring seven. No claims of responsibility for that either. Our correspondent Johnny Miller now, who is in Donetsk, located in the Donbass region east of Ukraine. He explains which districts have witnessed the most intense fighting since Friday as Russia goes ahead with its operations to take Donbass.
So I'm in Donetsk at the moment. You can hear the sporadic incoming of fire as the Ukrainian army shells Donetsk. Yesterday it was in the Kurbyevsky district, not far from here, which was shelled for large parts of the day. Not too many casualties as people were able to find shelter. Today, this morning, it looks like to be the Leninsky district. I could see the rising smoke outside my window earlier. So there's a lot more shelling by the Ukrainian Army of Donetsk in recent days and weeks. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is because NATO weapons have been able to reach the front line and so have been able to shell the center. Now, Vladimir Putin yesterday, speaking in St. Petersburg, was mainly speaking about the economy, but he also made a comment about the shelling in Donetsk. And he said this, that the shelling of Donetsk by the Ukrainian army would end when the Russian army is able to come down from the north of here and attack the heavily fortified positions on the outskirts of this city. Now, in saying that, he rather gave away Russia's battle plans. At the early stages of this war, Russia took Ukraine by surprise by sending troops in from the north and the south around Kharkiv. But now it's very clear what Russia's trying to do, and that's to take the rest of Severodonetsk and then to sweep down here, take the rest of Donbass.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Just take a look at the behavior of the American statesman. Their style of speech is similar to that of psychopathic personalities. They make threats. They order assassinations. They slander. They helplessly beg for assistance. They attack the stability and security of other nations. They horse around like a bunch of lunatics. Their behavior is not characteristic of logical, wise politicians. Of course, this behavior is due in large part to the reflection of American failure in different parts of the world. The failure in Afghanistan and Iraq. They entered Iraq and Afghanistan with the promise of freedom, democracy, and human rights. Today, after the passage of several years, the situation in these two countries is so severe that no nation would want to be in the same situation. Insecurity, poverty, increasing domination of arrogant powers, jeopardizing their national interest, disregarding the rights of the people, and the subsequent total failure in achieving the goals they had once announced, or the interior motives they had not announced, are very prevalent there. These failures are reflected in the behavior of American politicians and in their discord, disagreement, and decisions. That is the way the global bullies behave.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What should one do to confront this bullying? The Imam's advice was to resist. Fortunately, today, all the political groups in the country expressed their loyalty to the path of the Imam. This is an auspicious phenomenon. This was not the case in some eras after the revolution. There were some political movements that openly talked about turning their backs on the Imam's path. Fortunately, today, political groups in our country talk about their inclination towards the thoughts and path of the Imam. One of the most prominent points of the Imam's path, which is reflected in his testament and all his remarks, is the need for determined resistance against covetous, arrogant powers. The Iranian nation and all the different political groups, as well as the elites inside the country who are loyal to the Imam and his thoughts and decisions, must safeguard this stance with full strength.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Guided me from all the ways
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
African leaders met in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, last month to address the current security and humanitarian challenges facing the continent. Now, the summit was expected to provide solutions that will lead the continent to recovery, peace and development. In his keynote address at the Continental Gathering, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said the summit came at a critical moment.
You will agree that this conference could not have come at a better time, considering the challenges posed by the increasing rate of internally displaced persons, refugees, and returnees migrants to our various countries and the continent at large.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, today we are focusing on the recently concluded extraordinary summits of the African Union that were held to tackle some of the major challenges facing the continent. We are asking, did African leaders achieve their objectives in Malabo? The second part of our program will be on reports by Russia that U.S.-controlled biolaboratories operating in Nigeria might be responsible for the current global monkeypox outbreak. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on the topics and send your comments on our social media handle.
AU Summit tackles challenges. African leaders closed the two extraordinary summits in Malabo late May, with most of heads of state pointing that terrorism, bad governance, and coup d'etat are interlinked and have worsened the humanitarian crises that plague the continent. The two-day conference by the African Union and hosted by the government of Equatorial Guinea was also part of marking the 20th year of the transformation of the Organization of Unity to African Union.
The first summit was dedicated to the humanitarian crisis and brought together African leaders and donors. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke at the session and highlighted the situation at the Horn of Africa.
The humanitarian situation is a concerning development for Africa that requires our collective response. The Horn of Africa sub-region in particular is among the most affected by the recent climate change-induced humanitarian crisis. This year, some parts of Ethiopia were hit by one of the worst droughts in years, resulting in the loss of livestock and displacement of people.
Now, to discuss the recently concluded African Union summit in Malabo, we contacted Claude Gatebuke, the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, did African leaders achieve their desired objectives during the summit in Malabo?
In my opinion, they didn't, because the African Union, a lot of the leaders who are within the African Union are already not, they're not the right people to solve the issue because they are part of the issue. Many of those leaders actually came to power through violent overthrows and extremism. In fact, if you look at, you know, various parts of the continent, many of those governments and those leaders are involved in some type of conflict. You look at Cameroon, for example. You look at what's going on in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon. They didn't talk about that.
During their meeting in Malabo, African leaders discuss efforts to fight a growing terrorist threat and push back against a recent run of military coups on the continent. The chairperson of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mahamat, urged African countries to use their own troops in combating the terror threat facing Africa and so reduce dependency on foreign forces.
While we have the means and the men necessary, African armies count, according to certain recent estimates of 2022, some 2.7 million men. Mobilizing just 1 or 2% of this force would give us the means necessary to reduce our dependence on foreign forces and to have a chance of success against terrorism.
How did the conference tackle the growing insecurity challenge, especially terrorist attacks? Should we expect to see a reduction in terrorism after the summit?
I think it's all business as usual. Again, I think that there has been so much paying lip service to the issues versus resolving the issues. What is the root cause of these issues? That's where it needs to start. And a big major part of it is the fact that people are not able to self-determine in many of these countries, where they are not able to determine their own destiny and their own affairs. There is either the leaders in those countries. I mean, look at countries, you know, the various leaders that are there. Many of them, again, came through violence, or they just do not look after the affairs of the citizens. So you're going to have disgruntled people. Disgruntled people will go into anger, and anger will lead to violence. So until the issue of self-determination is resolved, I think it's going to be hard to see a reduction in terrorism and violence, because violence comes from the fact that people have issues. They would like to have them resolved. They would like to be a part of the solution, but they are kept out. And so they result to violence. Also, because of the history, many people, you know, see violence as maybe one way to access power.
The African Union has suspended four members, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and Sudan, following military takeovers. Now, representatives from these countries were excluded from the Malabo summit. With the recent rise in the number of military coups, African leaders are concerned about the potential for military intervention in their own countries and are now calling for action to stop these coups.
The resurgence of coup d'etats in our region is a matter of grave concern. This evolution challenges the democratic way of life we have chosen. Let us address this danger, this dangerous trend, collectively and decisively.
Now, West Africa has been plagued by coups over the recent past. Did the summit take measures to end these military takeovers?
I do like the policy of the African Union to not to keep out those who come to power via coups. And I think maybe that is one of the measures that could work. But I think the African Union needs to consider that coups are not just when the military comes and takes over and removes civilians or removes, previous governments, whether they're civilians or military. There is also the issue of the change of constitutional terms. And that also, to me, should be considered a coup. And with that, I think the summit did not address that. The issue of coups, it's nice not to include those who are the coup makers. But at the end of the day, those who commit coups while they're in power by changing the constitutions and extending their terms are also they're part of the issue. And so I think until that issue is also resolved, the issue of coups is half, not even halfway resolved. Leaving out the coup makers is just a partial answer.
One major observation at the AU summit was that the continent is still dependent on external aid to face its challenges, including the funding of the African Union. To what extent was the slogan, African Solutions to African Problems, attained in this summit?
For us to see that this African Solutions to African Problems was attained is, I think we can start with the African Union and how it's financed. Most of the financing that comes into the African Union is through the European Union or China. And until the African Union is financed by Africans, by African nations, I believe that that would be the way to show and to start showing that we actually have African solutions to African problems. Those who benefit the most from African resources are the outsiders, Europe and Western countries, in, you know, Europe, the U.S., Canada, Australia, countries like that are the biggest beneficiaries. China, of course, and a number of others are the biggest beneficiaries of African resources. When we have that, then we can say that we have African solutions to African problems. And there are many, but that would be a start. And I want to see that.
In 2002, First Ladies of Africa came together to form the Organization of African First Ladies, with the objective to be a united voice for Africa's most susceptible citizens, women, and children. Speaking during the Malabo Summit, Nigeria's First Lady, Aisha Buhari, said the input of African women is critical in tackling the current humanitarian crisis.
Work closely with the AU Special Envoy on women, peace and security to ensure that our interventions are aligned with those of the African Union. Commit to the achievement of Agenda 2026 and United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325. Embark on programs that focus on peace building, education, health, and women empowerment.
Will the decisions taken at the African Union Summit in Malabo impact the lives of ordinary people in Africa? Or in other words, should Africans have hope that their leaders are working to solve their problems?
And in countries where the leaders are self-imposed on the people, it's the people cannot hope to see solutions and for things to get better from those leaders, because those leaders are a big part of the problem. If the African Union can self-finance, that would be another good start. If Africa can benefit from the resources in the various countries versus it benefiting mostly countries away from Africa, Western countries, China, Australia, and others, then we can hope that Africans can have hope in the leaders that we have and the decisions that they make, whether it's at this summit or another summit. But right now, I think all of it is mostly lip service.
Well, there you have it. African leaders need to ensure that the masses benefit from the continent's massive natural resources. We'd like to thank our guest, Claude Gachebuke, for his insight on the recent African Union summit in Malabo. Now, we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall look into the recent assertion by a Russian official that U.S.-controlled biological laboratories in Nigeria are responsible for the spread of monkeypox. Stay with us.
Recently, a Kenyan trade delegation visited Iran to get acquainted with the capabilities of the Islamic Republic. The delegation visited ceramic tile factories, dairy and food processing machines manufacturers, solar energy technology companies, and a bitumen production plant. Last year, Iran's trade with Kenya stood at $83.2 million, which was an increase of 46% compared to the previous year. In 2021, Iran's exports to Kenya recorded an increase of 52%, with the country exporting 200,000 tons of goods worth $77.1 million to the East African country. In 2021, Iran's imports from Kenya were 1,634 tons of goods worth $6.3 million, and this was a 1% increase compared to the previous year. U.S. Biolabs in Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Igor Kirillov, the head of the Russian Nuclear, Chemical and Biological Protection Troop, says at least four U.S.-controlled biological laboratories operate in Nigeria, where monkeypox came from.
The Russian official urged the World Health Organization to investigate the activities of U.S.-funded Nigerian laboratories in Abuja, Zaria and Lagos. Meanwhile, the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, NCDC, issued a statement categorically stating that Nigeria has no laboratories where monkeypox virus is generated. The centers dismissed reports that there are four U.S.-controlled biological laboratories operating in Nigeria.
A press statement released by the agency and signed by the Director General of NCDC, Dr. Ifedayo Adetifa, said the Russian statement was not backed by any evidence. Now, for more on the assertion by Russia that the U.S. has disease-spreading biolabs in Nigeria, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, Russia says that the U.S. has biolabs in Nigeria where monkeypox came from. What's your take on this statement by the military in Moscow?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting development, and it adds to previous work to shed light on U.S., biolaboratories that are supposedly in a number of different countries across the world. I think we need to be asking why the UN doesn't investigate these facilities that the U.S. has, this and you know, isn't verifying this evidence that's been revealed by Russia, and especially since we're in the context of, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic and now this new monkeypox outbreak. And so I think, you know, given the limited visibility and oversight related to these facilities, it makes sense that, you know, there's some sort of investigation.
Igor Kirillov, the head of the Russian Nuclear, Chemical and Biological Protection Troops, has called on the WHO to investigate the alleged U.S. role in spreading monkeypox, noting it is necessary to point out a strange coincidence that requires additional inspection by specialists. The WHO says monkeypox cases have been reported in Africa since the beginning of 2022.
To the monkeypox challenge, I can confirm that since the beginning of 2022, cases have been reported in Africa from Cameroon, the Central African Republic, the Republic of the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Liberia, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. WHO and partners are joining forces to urgently understand the magnitude and cause of the global outbreak.
Why would the United States require three biolabs in Nigeria?
I think there have been some who have alleged that the U.S. military, you know, regularly produces bio weapons, right? Like, you know, viruses, bacteria, and toxins that are in direct violation of, you know, the UN Convention on the Prohibition of Biological Weapons. And I think, you know, that is something that, you know, it pose real threats to folks who aren't aware, right, unwitting people that could be systematically exposed to dangerous pathogens and other incurable diseases. And so we could even look at, the number of deadly outbreaks in the countries that supposedly have these biolab laboratories.
Nigerian medical expert Professor Philip Njemanze has called on the federal government to shut down all U.S. biolaboratories in the country pending full investigations over the alleged leak of monkeypox pathogen biomaterials from these biolabs. Now, should the Nigerian medical community be concerned over the existence of U.S. biolabs in this country?
Well, I think there is cause for concern. I mean, here in the U.S., we also have, some biolaboratories where, hundreds of lab mistakes, safety violations, and near-miss incidents have occurred. And, biological laboratories in the U.S. Over the past few years that put, scientists, their colleagues, and the general public at real risk, right? And there's, a lack of oversight even here locally. So, even when, these research facilities commit, safety or security breaches, there's no accountability, and that's in the U.S. And so I guess the point is, it's probably a lot worse for the ones that have been named in Nigeria that Russia's pointed out.
Apart from Nigeria, the United States also operates biolabs in several locations across Eastern, Southern, and Central Africa. Do the countries hosting these biolabs really know what is going on inside these facilities?
I think there's a way that, that these biolabs, that their work has been classified and, it's been kept secretive. There might be some countries that are aware of the facility, but I don't think they have a good idea in terms of what's taking place within these laboratories. And that just speaks to, the lack of, control and sovereignty that a lot of these countries have as it relates to their dealings with the United States in the West. And so I think, I don't think that these countries are very aware of what's going on inside these facilities.
Russia says it possesses information about the U.S. biolabs around the world, including in Western Ukraine and Africa. Now, this has raised concern across Africa, a continent which has been ravaged by diseases such as AIDS and Ebola. Now, should African countries now demand that the United States shows transparency on the activities of these secretive biolabs, and if it refuses, then they should be shut down?
Right. These countries should definitely expel these labs and the U.S. and this military from their borders, right, as, the example of monkeypox has shown, right, their presence brings nothing but death and devastation. Most of these countries, and especially the African continent, are under neocolonial control. And so, the rulers of these countries kind of get their authority to govern not from the will of the people, but from the support that they, gain from the U.S. and other Western countries or their masters. So, I think it would really take kind of the organized masses to liberate themselves from neocolonialism and really be able to expel this threat.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. So we'd like to thank Mr. Tunde Osazuwa, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. So drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners from all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, if you have been following such shows, we are trying to answer some doubts on misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs with presence of Islamic scholars from Qom Seminary students. We have today invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary School as an Islamic researcher to answer the questions of ours in this very session. Sheikhana, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us, Sheikh, to have you here. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, is about our actions and duties that we need to perform and do in order to satisfy the whole existence of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi, Imam Zaman alayhi salam. Sheikh, it has been asked that what should we do to satisfy Imam and make him pleasant of what we are doing? Is there any specific action that makes him happy so that we perform those and do those actions? What is expected from us to do? And definitely we know that based on the religiously speaking, based on the duties that we have as a Muslim, we have understood that we have to perform the wajibat and whatever is compulsory and mandatory on us and refrain from performing muharramat. But it has been said that what makes Imam Zaman happy of us and what kind of activities make him so that we actually focus on those actions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We have in the supplication of nutbah, wal-ijtihad fi ta'ati wa-ijtinab ma'asiyati. To try to have endeavor in order to obey the Imam, to follow the orders of Imam, and to be away from the, you know, whatever he has forbidden, okay? And to not to disobey Imam, the orders of Imam, you know, may Allah hasten his reappearance. I want to say that there may be best action which give the pleasure of Imam al-Mahdi, the last savior of humanity, and, you know, is just to follow the orders of Imam, okay? Just to, you know, try to obey the orders and recommendation of Imam al-Mahdi, the last savior of humanity.
Very true.
And it is easy said, you know, sometimes we are in some circumstances, sometimes it's, you know, may be difficult to practice what is our responsibility. Yeah. Of course, I'm not talking about the, for example, jurisprudential aspect of that. It is granted. It is a basic, okay? Just to do your obligations, I mean, Islamically speaking, according to the Islamic laws and jurisprudence, and to be away from the committing any evil and sin, it is a basic for any Muslim who want to follow up Islamic teaching. But behind that, what is your, for example, what is a pleasure of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam, okay? And try to follow the orders of Imam, and what is your, let's say, individual responsibility, societal responsibility. Sometimes it is necessary to engage in, into some practice and many other things which is related to the, you know, pleasure of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam. For example, we have that in many supplication, وَجْعَلْنَا اللَّهُمَّ مِنْ أَنصَارِهِ وَأَعْوَانِهِ وَأَتْبَائِهِ وَشِيَتِهِ. Oh Allah, put me among the helpers of Imam al-Mahdi and who give assistance to him. And of course, those people, atbaihi, which means those people who follow the orders of Imam, and real Shia and follower of Imam al-Mahdi, last savior of humanity. These are among the maybe most important actions which give and which provide the pleasure of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam.
So it has been, because you know, the question in the continuation of the same explanations of yours, that how can we be among his atma'awan and ansar, those who are helping and assisting Imam? So because in case we find a way to make him happy, then we will be included, inshallah, in, among his helpers. So what are the prerequisites of doing, and what are the prerequisites of being so?
You know, we cannot go to the detail of that. It's different from individual to another individual. In you know, in one time, in one place, there are, they can be, it has a lot of variety to different people. Okay, just we want to give the general idea of that and general criteria for what is a criterion if you want to be from the followers of Imam al-Mahdi and try to give and to provide the a pleasure of Imam al-Mahdi, okay? But it's different. We cannot go to the detail of that. Maybe for one, for an individual, according to your career, it's different, okay? Or for example, in one land, in one country, is different from another country, okay? But, you know, this depends on the circumstances and the condition of people.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.